totally one of those things that is designed. It's very Hitchcocky, too, to make you uncomfortable, that movie, Match Point. Yeah, that whole hour just got away from us. Behold the time-sucking ability of Clyde. All right. Clyde Lewis, ladies and gentlemen. See him hit on underage women and possibly your girlfriend tonight at Dante's. There you go. 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. Rick, every wedding reception I've ever been to has been totally effing boring. I haven't even been to a gay reception. I feel depraved. Oh, this is from Gay Bob. I feel depraved. I believe he means deprived. Or possibly both. Yeah, the key is to take Clyde with you. We were saying that, like, we really ought to rent Clyde out. Clyde ought to be rented out as just a live wire. You know, through all wedding receptions everywhere. You know what I mean? He'll just hit one, or, you know, any event. It doesn't matter. A corporate event, bat mitzvah, doesn't matter. Just, Clyde is there, just totally liquored up and ready just to wreak havoc on whatever. Ladies and gentlemen, let us now continue the new news hour at 107 with Tim Riley.
And now, from the Ministry of Truth,
yes, sir.
This is Tim Riley.
Well, what would politics be about John Kerry being around? He's winnable. Giving Democrats a tremendous chance to regain control of Congress. We're going into
Bank B
number
all over
one.
That. All right. This is John Kerry.
John Kerry.
All right.
They will hold this lying accountable. If you want to hold it accountable, if Americans are fed up, and I hope they are, and they've had enough, then vote for Democrats.
He was cut off in mid-sentence there.
I don't care. They'd had enough in 2004, you tool. They'd had enough 2 years ago. They had enough, which means you had enough to actually win. I mean, look, here's the thing. I guess I should be glad that Kerry didn't win in a weird way because, again, it gives us so much grist for the mill. I will say this. They were talking to Nancy Pelosi, who's the presumptive Speaker of the House at this point. And they asked her flat out. They said if the Democrats gain control of Congress, are they going to try to impeach George Bush? Now, she said she is obliged to say no. She has to. It is just like Karl Rove is obliged to say, no, I feel good that we are going to retain control of both houses. I don't know where the truth lies, probably somewhere in between, but I mean, they asked Nancy Pelosi about that, and let me just say this, and I know we get the contingent of people out there that feel like we spend too much time talking badly about George W. Bush, but he's the president. That's what happens. When you're on top, you get the slings and arrows, baby. That's just the way of the world. Somebody else wins presidency next time, you know, they'll get it. You know, George Bush becomes grand, irremovable dictator. We will continue to make fun of him. The thing about it is, though, Here's why I pray for this, because you know that there's nothing that appeals to me just like discord and chaos and anarchy. And that's why it's painful and ridiculous and retarded and stupid and puritanical and hypocritical that whole Monica Lewinsky thing was. It was great for somebody like me because it was just political chaos happening left and right, where every day the country just felt like it was swirling in some sort of hideous vortex that was going towards some sort of an awful drain at the bottom of a particular political bathtub. That's what it would be like. Can you imagine if the Democrats got enough control of the Congress that they decided to go after George W. Bush? I mean, it would just be, I would never have to do show prep again. I would just show up here like 10:59. It's all, the show would do itself. I wouldn't even have to be here. I could just turn on the phones remotely and the show would just run itself like clockwork. Be fantastic. Just in terms of just pure, I bet, and I'm just speculating here, I bet if the Democrats gained enough control that they felt confident to try to impeach George W. Bush, I bet we could actually spark a completely violent and bloody civil war in the streets of this country. That'd be fantastic. So, I mean, that's...
As long as it doesn't spill over to the suburbs.
No, that's fine. You know, as long as it sort of happens in, like, Florida and in the red states. That'd be fine, man. All right, there you go. Here's Tim Riley.
Hey, President Bush has gently chided his father for comments about the upcoming election earlier this month. The former President Bush was quoted as saying he'd hate to think about what his son's life would be like if the GOP lost its majorities in the House and Senate. When asked about this comment, the current President Bush told ABC's This Week, quote,
"Dad, don't make him put you in a home.
Speculating like this.
I'm the person that believes we'll continue to control the House and the Senate. I can't tell you what the margins are going to be, but I believe our candidates will go out and talk about the issues that matter and we'll win."
I've been told to say these words. I don't really know what they mean. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
He said his father shouldn't have made any such comments.
He shouldn't be speculating like that, because he should have called me ahead of time and I tell him they're not going to.
Okay. All right. Sounds like somebody's forgotten who got him the job of president. Sounds like somebody forgot who got him a baseball team and several failing oil companies. How do you fail at an oil company in Texas, in this country? So there you go. I've walked a lot more carefully there. This somebody's going to get taken out back. All right, taken to the woodshed. It's like, well, who's that guy? What's his name from the Willamette Week? I want to say Jefferson Davis. Is that right?
Jefferson Smith.
Jefferson Smith. Is that his name?
Jefferson Davis was the president of the Confederacy.
Maybe not him then. Jefferson Smith. Is that his name? Oh God! Now
let's just call him Jefferson.
I feel dumb now. But he was, you know, he's the guy. He hosts Candidates Gone Wild. Yeah, yeah. And he wants to come on to talk about, what's it called, Trick or Vote? He wants to come on to talk about a thing called Trick or Vote, which
they,
I believe,
didn't ask me back. I don't know.
Were you not asked back to Candidates Gone Wild?
No.
With
well,
Byron?
No, they didn't take Byron either.
Oh.
Yeah, Byron drunkenly came out to me. He's like, you know what? I don't think they're going to hire you this time. He's like, I think I'm out too. Okay.
Well, you know, I think that might be, look, we love Byron here, but I think you might be, that's a little guilty by association, Sarah. I think they might be like, that whole...
Well, plus you have a better chemistry with people you're familiar with.
It's true.
On stage or anywhere else. You can't duplicate what's heard on this program.
Well, it's true, and also...
outside parties.
And just that Byron just gets really drunk really fast, and just everything becomes... Byron becomes like Clyde at the wedding, you know, which is everything is just an opportunity to grab the microphone and make a lot of jokes about, you know, about oiling up Lou Ferrigno and boobs and so forth. And so you were not asked by. That's fine.
I have not heard of it, but I'm a big fan of Jefferson. He was really fun to work with.
He's a great guy.
He's really smart, funny. I liked him a lot.
So he wants to come on sometime this week to talk about their Trick or Vote thing, which is
getting the kids out to vote.
That's exactly.
And that works every time.
That's what I'm talking about. And it's, look, we'll have him on because he's a cool guy, and because we have to maintain our.
Are we rocking the vote?
It
never
works. I know it doesn't work. And this is the thing. We might as well talk about this. So Mark Baumgarten, who wrote a very nice, very glowing article about this show when we first came back on the air, and who was working on a much bigger article that then... It's kind of the ironic thing is, Mark Baumgarten for the Willamette Week interviewed me for like 46 hours, including a trip to Kennewick, by the way, a whole day-long field trip to my hometown, for this, like, 8-page article he was going to write about, like, why corporate radio is dumb and won't hire Rick Emerson or whatever. And then, like, the whole thing got scuttled because they hired us. And so it became, like, a 1-page sort of puff piece. And I don't mean puff piece, like, in a bad way. It was very, just, you know, but it was not, like, a deep probing article. It was just, like, a Rick is gone, now the show is back, blah, blah, blah. He's moving. He's moving back, and so it's like we have to maintain all. He's moving back to Minneapolis, so we got to maintain all of the journalistic contacts we have, like the actual real media. So we'll have Jefferson on this week to talk about Trick or Vote. But the thing is, it doesn't work. It never works. It doesn't look. Young people don't vote. Young people, like everybody in America, they may not be apathetic and stupid, but I don't really know that they're the life-changing, world-shaking force that everybody seems to think that they're going to be. Look, if the young people didn't vote, and when I say young people, I know that it makes me sound like an old preacher, but if the young people didn't vote in 2004, look, if they didn't vote in the last presidential election, if that couldn't get them out to vote, really, what now is going to get them out? Really, what would it take? Is it going to take somebody coming to your house and, like, breaking your grandmother's kneecaps? Is
that Alexakis? He can get them out.
Yes. That's exactly it.
Tim should totally dress as Art Alexakis for Halloween.
Genius!
Oh, my God.
That's a fantastic idea.
No, I already have my beef vendetta costume.
Oh,
that's pretty cool.
Hello. That's
genius. Stevie Wonder Woman.
So there you go. I mean, it's nothing, you know, they don't vote. No one votes. Nothing changes. Nothing gets better. But it's like, how am I going to have this guy in later on this week and, like, smile at him? And this is going to be one of those bad interviews when we have him in. I mean, he's great. Well, he's funny.
Tomorrow, it's going to be one of those bad interviews.
But it's like, how can I have the guy in from the Willamette who's responsible for getting the youth to vote so we can make a positive democratic change when I'm sitting here rooting for civil war? I'm sitting here rooting for them to impeach Bush so that violent civil war erupts in the country.
Pretend the program starts at 10 a.m. that day.
Only. Totally. And have him in the Kramer
Now, Jefferson, he's not a dumb man. He obviously is aware of the problems. I don't think he'll be bringing up anything he's not aware of. I mean, I think it'll be just fine.
It all just exists as a, you know, the only purpose politics now serves me is just entertainment. That's what I'm saying. So as long as things continue to go badly, I'm a happy guy. That's all it is.
Maybe don't say that.
That's what I'm saying. It's like I now only root for things to come apart, it seems.
Well, then maybe Jefferson can help you see the errors of your way.
Maybe he can make me a believer again.
Maybe he can.
Maybe he can remind Rick Emerson how to dream. Probably not, but, you know, we'll see.
There have been probably a couple of people listening at Reed College. I might appreciate that.
Oh, hello. Somebody sent me a Christina Aguilera photo.
I hope somebody sends you something really repellent and it says, naked Christina Aguilera.
That happened for the longest time. We used to have that liner that ran that said, send your nude pictures of Britney Spears, too. And guys would send me a picture of, like, it'd be like some dude, like, getting on with a horse. And it would be called, like, Chris, it would be like hot Britney nude boob JPEG. I'd be like, yeah, wow, you know. And God, have we all heard that hideous story about the guy and the dog in Tacoma?
Yes.
All right. There you go. Sarah's countenance indicates that she has not heard the story. You want to know?
No.
It's everywhere. It's not hard to find.
Okay, what?
What else is there to know? There is apparently a new law. Apparently, a man in Tacoma, and I will just give you the broad strokes here. Apparently, a man in Tacoma, this is a real news story, by the way. This is not like fake Inquirer news. This is a real news story. And it's one of those stories, like Monica's stained dress, that is great because you get to see guys like actual upstanding, so-called real mainstream, respectable reporters talking about something completely horrifying and awkward. A man in Tacoma is apparently going to be the first test of the state's new anti-bestiality law after his wife snapped cell phone photographs of him on the porch having Congress.
Oh, my God.
With a pit bull. Of course, it's Tacoma. It had to be a pit bull. It wouldn't be a gentle dog with a collar or something.
It's not going to be a chihuahua.
So was his wife... Please tell me that she wasn't taking him for fun and she was...
No, she was just like, you're not having sex with that dog again, are you? No. You know, and then she sort of leaned around the corner like, snap, snap, snap. Right. And
that's the end of the story. Let's talk about Nancy Pelosi.
Here's Tim Riley.
So we haven't spoken about Nancy Pelosi in at least 10 minutes, and I think it's time to do so.
She has got very large bosoms. Have you noticed that about her? She tries to cover them up, but it's difficult because...
That just makes you want them more, right, Rick?
Bigger than a chihuahua.
This is how I talk to you, and then they do this in front of Laura.
Let's just have Laura on a conference call someday for the entire program so she can hear the casual back-and-forth locker room-type banter that we engage in.
Despite calling President Bush incompetent, Pelosi told the program 60 Minutes that it is not a personal attack on the president.
This isn't personal. This is about... Sounds personal. He's incompetent.
Bouncing music behind her there. She's doing jazz or something. And hard as it is to believe, because, again, somebody told me the other day that our program was sounding a little too partisan with our constant railing on George W. Bush. And here's the thing. He's obviously a deeply stupid person, but at this point, it really isn't even partisan because I'm no more a Democrat than I am a Republican. Democrats are just as stupid and evil.
I don't vote at all.
No. So, I mean,
I did. I never want to vote again after the last election. It doesn't make a difference.
No, that's the thing. So in case anybody out there is just like, we had a bunch of stupid Democrats, damn Republican bad. We don't care about anything. We don't care about either party. I no longer have any aspirations of changing anything with my vote. I no longer believe that the American political process will benefit anybody or have any effect.
It has nothing to do with my life.
No. Has in no way will it have any positive effect. So, kids, if you're listening right now, I'd like to assure you your vote means nothing. It is useless and meaningless. It will achieve none of the goals that they tell you it will. So now, you know, it really has just become one big, long-running sitcom for me. That's all it is. Which is why I root for things like impeachment and civil war. I remember during the 2000 election when it was first conclusively demonstrated to you that it really didn't matter whether you voted or not. I remember seeing those bumper stickers like, don't blame me. My vote was shredded. My vote is in a box, still uncounted. But I remember watching during the 2000 election. Do you remember seeing those news? Where were you in 2000, Sarah? Were you here?
I was in London.
You were in London? So you were watching in a foreign country. That must have been weird.
It was really weird. And everyone that I was at school with was from the East Coast. So everyone was for George W. Bush.
Really? From the East Coast?
Mm-hmm.
That seems odd.
Yeah, it was a bunch of New Yorkers and people from New Jersey. It was me and like two other people who...
Were they all rich kids or something?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That explains it then, because that was just seems strange.
Yeah, I somehow ended up at this fancy college in London with all these, yeah, like really super rich East Coast kids, like
totally makes
daughters
sense,
and sons of ambassadors. And
skull
stuff.
And bones types. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I remember watching in Florida when, like, they're in there trying to, you know, what is it? Oh, yeah, count the votes, and they're in that room. Remember those, and the GOP guys are outside in the hallway, like, let us in, you know, and it was like they were pounding on the door of the counting room. And I remember watching this news coverage in Florida, like, as it happens, as there's, like, Democrat or Republicans outside in the hallway banging on the locked door of the counting room, like, trying to break it down. And I remember having the giddy, like, here it is. It's all about to happen. You know, just reaching for my popcorn and just cuddling up underneath an Afghan on the couch, just waiting for the whole country to rip itself apart at the seams, just thinking I was finally going to get to see all of my horrific dreams come to fruition. And then it didn't happen. It was like all of the tumblers in the lock clicked but one. You know what I mean? So, but the good news is we've never really gotten away from that. We continue to veer on the knife edge of complete social and political collapse in this country. So the only good news is that I'm going to be around to see it happen. I won't be around to see global warming kill everybody, probably, but I will be here to see the entire country just implode at the center, you know, during one of these political seasons. So good times for everybody.
Say Nancy Pelosi. How do your negative comments about the president raise the level of civility on Capitol Hill?
Well, this is we're in a political debate here. We didn't come here to have a tea party together and toss a coin to see who would win on an issue.
Well, all right. Well, there you go. You know who's helping to run that? Like at the DCCC is being run by this guy Rahm Emanuel. And Rahm Emanuel, if you know him, he was one of the fixers for the Clinton and campaign. And man, the Democrats. Here's the thing, man. The thing about the Democrats is the Democrats. This is like this is like Ollie Foreman, where. In one of the few sports metaphors you will ever hear me use on the program, where it's like Ali being so psyched up going to beat Foreman, and they just said they were like if Ali had lost to Foreman, that would have been the end of his life. He'd psyched himself up and had put so much pressure on himself and had been so boastful going into that Rumble in the Jungle fight that if Foreman had beaten him, Ali would have just had to go and, like, just, you know, toss himself off a cliff somewhere. That's what it is with the Democrats, man. They are talking, and Nancy Pelosi, chief among them, they are talking so big and so loud and making so many boasts and proclamations about this that if Karl Rove schools them again, it's time for them to just go and live in a monastery somewhere and never show their faces again, is Tim Riley.
Time for a snuff watch.
Fantastic. I mean, not that it's fan, not, you know what I mean. I enjoy hearing this little piece of music, what I meant.
Jane Wyatt, the lovely Serena actress who for 6 years on Bobby Knows Best, was one of TV's favorite moms, is dead.
She was cute, too. It's hard to imagine now because you just see her Spock's mom. But yeah. Jane Wyatt, back in the day, she was a very, very pretty woman.
She was 96.
Really? 96?
96.
I guess I thought she was dead already.
No, she was living in Bel Air, of all places, and she died of natural causes in her sleep. She had a successful film career in the 30s and 40s, notably as Ronald Coleman's lover in 1937's The Lost Horizon. But it was her years as Robert Young's TV wife Margaret Anderson on Father Knows Best that brought the actress some lasting fame. She appeared in 207 half-hour episodes from 1954 to 1960 and won 3 Emmys as Best Actress in a Dramatic Series in 1958 to 1960. Why was this called a dramatic series? I don't know.
Father Knows Best? Yeah. It was a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know why it was called that. Her role wasn't the only time in 60 years of film and TV that Wyatt was cast as a warm, compassionate wife and mother. She even played Mr. Spock's mom in the original Star Trek series and the feature Star Trek IV.
The one with the whales.
The Voyage Home. Never a star, Wyatt enjoyed career longevity for her roles as a genteel, understanding woman. Among her most notable films, Gentleman's Agreement, Boomerang, and Buckskin Frontier.
But she was not... Buckskin Frontier sounds like a porn,
it does
porn film. We've been riding herd all day. I could use a rubdown. She was not married to Ronald Reagan, though.
No, you're thinking of Jane Wyman.
Jane Wyman. I always get Jane Wyman and Jane Wyatt.
And they look
confused.
Similar.
Yeah, well, they all look like 50s.
You know, 50s housewife.
50s housewife. They all look the same.
I got a second one here.
All right. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Who else is dead?
Actress Phyllis Kirk, famous for her role as a damsel in distress in the 1953 3D classic horror House of Wax, is dead at the age of 79.
We were just talking about 3D earlier.
As a matter of fact, she died of a post-cerebral aneurysm at the Motion Picture and Television Hospital in Woodland Hills. After moving to Hollywood, she took on numerous television and film roles in the 50s, including House of Wax, in which she starred Vince Price.
Oh. Sarah has just put up on her computer screen the costume in which her dog Muppet will be dressed at Halloween, the Wonder Woman costume.
Well, that
costume.
Is cute.
Isn't that cute?
I think so, yes. And I think
like
I think Phyllis Kirk.
I was going to say, I'm sure that Phyllis Kirk is glad that we've interrupted her obituary to talk about dressing up a dog as a fictional Amazonian.
No, but that's she would want to be remembered in a world of laughter.
That's how Phyllis Kirk would have wanted it.
Absolutely, that's her snuff
and
watch.
She's goddamn dead. There you go, it's your snuff watch. The best show ever. Rick, this email says, if you dress up as Art Alexakis, I swear I will hunt you down and trick-or-treat at your house dressed as an IRS tax man. Just so you can open the door and say to me, here is the candy that I owe you. Good times. All right, there you go. I wanted to read that. All right, it's 503-733-2970. We'll come back, and you know... Oh, it happened. Somebody sent me a Christina Aguilera photo that was really a photo of a thing.
Something unspeakable.
Yes. Yes. As H.P. Lovecraft would say, that which cannot be named. Improbably, we'll come back with even more Tim Riley after this.
You're kidding me.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm prepared for that.
No. You got time. We'll come back. Well, because we're trying to make up, because Clyde just took over that whole news hour like some sort of bearded kudzu. That's funny, first. Oh, we got to talk about Scotty J, too. We called Scotty J from the wedding reception. Scotty was just I was walking in the hallway just now. He's like, so, sounds like everybody was at the wedding reception. And then he just gives me the long stare.
Oh, Scotty.
He shakes his head and walks away. It's White Yoakam. You stay there. Emerson Show. What a great bed this is. That's fantastic. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. Good news, everyone. Dateline Houston, Texas. Former Enron boss Jeffrey Skilling has been sentenced to more than 2 decades in prison. Skilling was once the energy trading company's chief executive. He was convicted for fraud, conspiracy, insider trading, and lying to auditors. He was found guilty in May of 19 counts over a scandal the Toys Corporation cited in bankruptcy. He and former chairman Kenneth Lay were tried together. God killed Lay over the summer through a heart attack, which was undoubtedly very painful. So there you go. Jeffrey Skilling. You are a very bad person. And you are now going to a... PMITA prison for the next 2 decades. So have fun with that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's now welcome to the Rick... Oh, wait, hold on. I'm completely without... let's welcome... Thank you with the...
thank you so much.
Welcome out of the Rick Emerson Show. Peter Carlin from the Oregonian. Hello, sir.
Hey, hi. How are you?
How's life? How are things?
Fine, okay.
You sound a little rushed, a little harried, a little hurried.
I don't know what you're talking about. Look, I don't have much time. Can you just keep going? No, I'm fine. Well, thank you. How's your head?
My head.
Last time I saw you, had a baseball cap clamped over your scabby head.
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate that. Hello to you, too. No, I still do. As a matter of I can actually, as of this coming Saturday, it's gone.
Oh, is that right?
So, yeah, well, so as of Saturday, I can, like, get a haircut and do all that other stuff. But the thing is, if you really care about this, it's not so much the actual, like, whatever, like the redness or whatever from the medical hair restoration, because it's not like just going in and like having a like a wig stuck on your head. I mean, it's like an actual, that's a medical procedure. So it's not so much the redness, though, as they had to cut my hair really, really short to do it. And so I've got this weird reverse mohawk where down the middle of my head, there's like a 6-inch swath where it's really like a quarter inch long, and then the rest of it is all normal.
Boy, Mrs. Emerson is loving this.
Yeah, she really is the best. Do you want to know, since you asked, though, do you want to know about the worst thing, though?
Yeah.
So this morning... So here I'm walking around the house, and, you know, my baseball cap, I'm home, obviously. But it's been like 8 days or 10 days, whatever, since I've done. Been very, very careful, very, very, like, good about not doing, you know, you don't want to, like, be injuring yourself in any way. But I bent over this morning because I dropped something on the floor of the kitchen, stood up, and I whacked the top of my head on a cupboard door.
Wow.
And that did not, let me assure you right now, friends and neighbors, that did not feel good. And
what was the first word out of your mouth?
It was exactly the first word that you were thinking of. It was not sugar, I assure you. So it's bam, like right into a cupboard. And I don't think I injured myself in any way, but boy, it did not feel good.
Really?
So it was a bad thing. But no, so this Saturday I will be losing the baseball cap. Although everybody in every band, every guy who holds a guitar in Portland has sent me a beanie or hat or other piece of merchandise from his band for me to wear.
Cool.
Really, the two best. I've got a hat. My friend of mine runs has a hip hop career. He sent me his record label's hat, and then I got a hat from the Pig and Pancake, which is of course the best restaurant in the history of the world. So I got that. So there you go. Anyway,
sweet.
Well, now that we've established my head, Peter. Oh, by the way, let me just say this. I was at a wedding this weekend. What was the name of the church? Do you remember the name of the church, Sarah? Was it a?
Oh, the church, it was the Friendly Church where Christ is head.
We were at a wedding reception this weekend, and yeah, that we were...
Oh, the Piedmont.
That we were across the street from a church, and in huge, and this was in Northeast somewhere, and the huge sign in front of the church said, the Piedmont Church, where Christ is head.
Wow.
Which, I got to tell you, as the evening went on and everybody got more and more drunk, that became even funnier. And by the end of the night, it was about the funniest thing we'd ever read anywhere. So
yeah, I think he's the vice chair in most other churches.
Oh, so you're going a whole different way. You're going a whole different angle.
I was trying to say, but I just wasn't going to go there, as the kids say.
You're not going to take the low road?
I didn't see the FCC being down with that.
You're not going to. You're not going to go to the low-hanging comedic fruit that we so readily embrace?
When I lived in New York, there was a guy that owned a car around the corner from my house that had a bumper sticker on the back that said, Jesus Christ, colon. So then you know what happens next. What you're going to read next is a commentary on Jesus Christ.
Yes.
It said, worthy to be praised. And I thought, that sounds a little kind of lukewarm, doesn't it?
Worthy, like adequate.
Worthy to be praised, right. Yeah, you know, like a kid that gets a C+.
Jesus Christ, satisfactory.
Yeah, exactly.
He'll do.
Yeah, yeah, in a pinch.
It's like that Delta, I think it was, that used to be their Delta slogan in like the mid-90s. Was like, Delta, we get you there.
Yeah, right.
And which is just like, really just the most backhanded, I mean, it's the faintest praise possible. Like, well, we can catch you there. Get off our back. You know, so... Let's talk about your column today, Monday, October 23rd, about The Wire.
Mm.
Now, I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to preface this by saying that I just finished watching season 2 of The Wire, like, a day and a half ago.
Okay.
So I am not, as the kids say, down with whatever happens. Now, did the fourth season does it premiere? When is the fourth season on?
Well, as of, like, the middle of September.
Oh, hello. I've got my finger on the cultural pulse. Well, I'm playing catch-up with that show, is my point. And
yeah.
And it's not, I didn't, like, so many things like Deadwood, I didn't consciously avoid it. It's just one of those things that there's not enough hours in the day. But I have to tell you, just having watched the first two seasons of The Wire, that may be, alongside The Shield, the best show on television. I mean, it's stunning. It's so, and I'm assuming that the third and maybe fourth seasons are just as good.
Well, the fourth season is spectacular, what I'm watching so far. And I actually, you know, I watched the first four or five episodes of the first season right around the same time I was watching the first four or five episodes of The Shield.
Right.
And at the time, you know, there was enough room in my heart for one new gritty urban cop show.
Sure.
And that was The Shield for me. And I kind of bailed on The Wire. Though, you know, I would always check back in every so often. But it just never made that huge of an impact on me. But, you know, I had different TV critic friends who were constantly slapping me upside the head and telling me that I was totally wrong and I really, really, really had to check it out.
It is amazing. And I have missed the third season. So I'm going to try. I think the third season's out on DVD, so I'm going to get that. And then I'm going to get caught up. And then HBO does such frequent repeats, I'll be able to get the speed in the fourth. But, I mean, it was created by David Simon, who's the guy who created, or at least wrote the book, Homicide: Life on the Street.
Yeah.
Which is probably the best I mean, it's so hard to say that it's the best ever, but I mean, really, up there again with The Shield and with Hill Street Blues, the best cop drama ever. Homicide was so great, and I was, it, for most of it, the time it was on the air, was such a great show. Mm-hmm. And he did The Corner as well, right?
Yeah.
And which I never saw. But I got to tell you, it's, you know, it's so hard sometimes because HBO, you know, they play on a different level. And but again, The Shield has proven that it's not just, you know, you don't, using the excuse that they're on HBO is no longer, that's no longer an acceptable excuse for making lackluster television. Say, well, they're HBO, they can do whatever they want because The Shield is so fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so The Wire is great, and so I'm absolutely getting caught up in that.
But hardly anyone's watching it, and the reason why, and what I was trying to say in my column today, is that for all that I love the show, I find it at times extraordinarily difficult to watch. Because it's painful.
It's bleak.
Their portrait of the underclass in West Baltimore is so vivid and so crushingly realistic. It just, you just feel like to watch it is just like getting the darkest side, you know, the darkest kind of sociology ever, because I get the sense that all that stuff is exactly right.
We have some friends of ours. I sound like a mob guy. Some friends of ours. But I know a couple people who are from Baltimore, as they say. And, and as time goes on, every time I'm such a nerd fanboy that every time I meet somebody who's from Baltimore, I always say, like, have you seen, you know, The Homicide, or have you seen The Wire, and how realistic is it? And, you know, it apparently just has the absolute ring of real truth to it. And
yeah.
Not that everybody in Baltimore lives that way, obviously, but again, a certain very distinct class. And this sounds like a very sort of trite way to explain it, but I know that you will know what I mean. When I watch, and again, having just finished season two of The Wire, when I watch The Wire, it is like watching one of those very real, very painful Springsteen songs play out in front of you.
Right.
You know, it's like watching
Nebraska.
Like Nebraska or The River or, one of those. Exactly. And it's just people that are, you know, it's like they are just born into last place.
Yeah.
You know, with no real way to get out of that.
And they're headed downhill.
Exactly. And it's just, and it's so great. And Laura and I have this, my wife and I have this thing that we talk about, that we have this cringe-inducing television that we watch, where it's television that, it's just, it's so real that it just makes you uncomfortable, and it almost is an endurance test to watch it. And The Shield is sort of that way, too, although not nearly as much as The Wire, because The Shield has enough sort of melodrama and enough sort of luridness to it.
Yeah. Plus, also, you know, to me, the thing with the new series, or this current season of The Wire, is that it involves kids.
Right.
Pretty little kids. Kids, and the whole point of the series is that you get these kids at the very beginning of middle school, like at eighth grade, and they could go either way. You know, that is the point at which they either go to the streets or they don't. And you realize, you know, I mean, and part of what the show makes you realize is, you know, I mean, it's just this heartbreaking moment where they are they're more attuned to the comings and goings of ice cream trucks than they are to people who actually want to buy their drugs.
Right.
But, you know, that's the only option that they have, both because it's the most feasible economic thing that they can see, and also because I think the structure and the discipline of a drug gang is what they're not getting at home.
You know, I read have you read that book, Freakonomics?
Mm-mm.
Freakonomics, which just blew my mind. It's one of those books where you feel like your brain has been taken apart and cleaned and polished and then put back together. And you just, it's like wiping off your glasses after having not cleaned them for like a year. And you just, you feel like you're just seeing things in a brand new way. And Freakonomics, which is like a nonfiction book. And it's one of those things where you read the description of it and it seems so mind-bogglingly dull. But you read it, and I mean, I read that book in like a day and a half. I mean, I blew through that book. It was like a chick-lit read. I mean, I blew through that in like a, you know, just less than 36 hours, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he does this great thing where he examines a drug-dealing gang as though they were a Fortune 500 company.
Yeah.
And he does this, you know, he identifies, like, who would be the CEO and who's the CFO and who are the interns and who are the janitors and who are the underlings and who's the board of directors. And the same thing. And you watch the show and you realize that... and also that financially speaking, that it just deals... When I watch The Wire, the great and weird thing about it is, it's not even that you have sympathy for drug dealers as such. It's just that it's not about feeling sympathy, but it's about recognizing that it seems like a completely logical career move.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it just seems obvious. Like, there's no question about it.
A whole array of financial and personal reasons.
Absolutely.
So. You know, and it's like the one place, you know, you get both financial and to an extent, like, emotional sustenance from this organization. And, you know, on the one hand, you think, wow, that's so amoral. It's immoral. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing to do, and it's a horrible situation. But, you know, and you don't just want to say, oh, it's society's fault and all that, but... You know, I mean, I think there's a kind of a social compact, you know, when in a society where theoretically, you know, you try to figure out where the people who really are in a position that where they can't help themselves or they're in, you know, an impossibly impoverished situation, and you try to, you know, you take the pressure off them. You try to figure out a way to make their lives livable. That's like your responsibility as a person.
The
our society, I think, in a wholesale way, has said, you know what, screw it.
Totally.
and that's what the wire's about. It's about what happens when that wire snaps.
Let's talk a couple real quickly, and you got some stuff you got to do, but two things, and sort of flip sides of the same coin. One, I have not yet watched 30 Rock. It's just sitting on my T-bone, I haven't watched it yet. But I expected almost nothing from that program. And again, I haven't seen it, but you seem to be heartily on board with it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it tickled me here and there. I laughed a couple times. It seemed promising enough, you know, and every so often you just want to take a break from ripping the stuffing out of everybody. You know, as comedies go this year, there's a pretty low bar, but 30 Rock clears it probably as well as anybody. You know, with the possible exception of that Ted Danson psychiatrist show, which I thought was real funny.
And then on the opposite side of this, something you and I have talked about, Paige, I don't know if you've seen today's USA Today. You do not strike me as the USA Today consumer.
No, but Robert Bianco, their TV critic, is A, really cool guy, and B, a really smart guy. So,
well,
and I did read saw a thing about the thing he wrote.
Studio 60.
Yeah, Robert's right on that stuff.
Sorkin show is not quite ready for prime time. And you know what? It is amazing how, A, the unanimity we all had about that show with the first episode and how great it was. And then just... And I like to think that it's not a herd mentality. I like to think that it is that we're all just spotting the same thing that is really there,
mm-hmm.
which is just that the show has great premise, but he just hasn't. It lacks follow through.
Well, he's not getting into the. I mean, I really feel like he's not getting into the viscera of the characters. And I thought, well, the point Robert made today, that it in many ways is just sort of about his own kind of self adulation or narcissism, is to some extent true. I mean, and saying that, it's still head and shoulders above a lot of the other shows that are on. I mean, particularly the new shows this fall. So, you know, it's not a total loser of a show.
It seems like but a lot of it, though, is, and again, don't get me wrong, I'm the guy who loves heavy-handed, long-winded, finger-pointing lectures.
Yeah.
But it does seem like it is sort of the one note of the I am Aaron Sorkin, and let me tell you all the ways in which, and it's too self-referential, that a lot of it is so much about how I am Aaron Sorkin, and let me tell you why this program is better than all the direct on television.
Well...
Which is true.
The other thing that he's not doing, though, and I was thinking about this the other day, I caught up with last week's episode last night, and I'm thinking, you know, if you look back, if you just read that Tom Shales book about Saturday Night Live, or read any of the books about the early days of Saturday Night Live, you had so many of these really cool, vivid, bizarro characters. Like, where's the Belushi character in this show?
Right.
You know, where is, like, the kind of, you know, that Harriet... Whatever.
Harriet Hayes
character is just sort of a stiff, you know. His whole fixation with faith and reason and all that, it's like, you know, in this context, I don't think it works as well as, like, you know, give me some totally, you know, tell me, open up the heart of some really neurotic comedian like Gilda Radner or Lorraine Newman or, you know, those the early women who were so brilliant on the show and were, you know, just fascinatingly nutty.
Well, I think what the points he's trying to make and the themes he's trying to use are not consistent with the materials he's being given to work with in that premise. I guess maybe that's the same thing you're saying. What he wants to say and what's in his toolbox are two different things right now.
Well, people on that show, well, you know, he created his toolbox, though, so I still think this is all about Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I mean, people on that show keep talking about what an important show Studio 60 is, you know, the fictional Studio 60, and yet whenever you see it, it kind of sucks.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, and also it's like, okay, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief, and I'm willing to buy the fact that the show is, like, important in the way Saturday Night Live used to be important. You know, it represents something, but why don't my character, you know, why doesn't the Matthew Perry character ever establish what it is about humor that's important to him?
Right.
You know, all they do is that, you know, I like being lectured at too. I mean, because Sorkin can do it, you know, better than anyone on TV. But his characters aren't saying anything interesting about these topics. It's all abstract. You know, it's all these kind of, it's just kind of vague puffery that doesn't go anywhere.
You know, and the problem is they did with the, you know, what boxers call leading with their right. And as I always go back to, it's that Judd Hirsch speech from the very first episode, which sets, I think, an impossible bar to ever reach again. You
it
know?
Was a beautiful moment, and I thought, wow, you know, if he's really going to open that up, that can of worms, and dig in there and figure out, you know, why it is that, you know, what is that disconnect between these people who want to do, you know, who are artists at heart and yet are working in the most commodified medium, you know, in the world, you know, American network TV. How do they square that in their hearts? You know, what's that to me is a really, really fascinating a conflict.
Do you think they're going to let Studio 60 go? I mean, the whole, it's got to be a fantastically expensive show. So they're going to let it go this season, do you think? And if do you think is, I mean,
they'll run it through. I would be shocked if they canceled it before the end of the season, because there's too many big people,
right,
too many big egos involved, and too many important, you know, potential players.
At the rate it goes now, would you call it to come back for a second season? Do you think it would?
Well, I'd have to see the numbers bouncing up a little bit before I'd make that call.
All right.
But they are, particularly now that the NBC is in such a huge cost-cutting mode.
Yeah, it's the wrong time to be mediocre.
Yeah, you know, and then by the time they'll declare victory and move on or something.
Yeah.
We told all the stories you wanted to tell, type of thing.
Yeah. We let the show come to its natural and graceful organic conclusion.
Right.
Yeah.
In the alley behind the building with a baseball hat.
Excellent. All right, read him in print in the Oregonian online at OregonLive.com and worship him as your new god. Peter Carlin, thank you, brother.
Hey, my pleasure.
All right, thank you. Talk to you next week. Peter Carlin, ladies and gentlemen. It's 503-733-2970. This email from our good friend DeLow. Rick, pleased to be reminding Sarah that her Stevie Wonder Woman costume should not consist of blackface to complement her shades and dreads.
I'm really not going to do that.
No, that was my first question. When
No, it's just sunglasses and black hair. Are you kidding me?
No, I know. When Sarah told me we were out shopping for my hat, she was like, I'm going to go as Stevie Wonder Woman. I'm like, like in blackface? She like hit me.
No. It's mostly Wonder Woman, just with a...
Well, with a little bit of soul.
I know. Well, all of them are so controversial because it's a fun idea. Like, Lisa's going as Dimebag Daryl Hannah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Dimebag Daryl Hannah is genius.
Yes. And, we've all... Actually, I went to the coast with a bunch of my friends, and we just sat around the campfire drunk for, like, 4 hours coming up with ideas.
Now,
and
is this a party they've done before, a blended celebrity
No,
thing?
No, but Nate's work has a huge Halloween party every year.
What's Nate going as?
Willie Half Nelson.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
He has like a full-on wrestler suit, and he's going to have the braided wig. And,
right on.
Yeah.
Excellent. Oz break here. We'll come back with Tim Riley at the Ministry of Truth. Oh, we got to talk about Scotty J as well. Got a big pile of gossip crap to get to as well. Don't go anywhere. It's 503-733-2970. We haven't even talked about hanging with Hogan. So much to do, so little time. 503-733-2970. It's the Rick Emerson Show. Don't go anywhere.